six of our syllabus. We spent our time yesterday looking at 17th century scientific thought. Found that this all changed, it begins to change with Galileo. We're coming to the time of the rise of modern science. Now, the new methodology, as we saw before, it was based on reason and options and simple, unsophisticated observation. We see the dawn of a new methodology, the combination of two things. Number one, mathematical reasoning, and experimental observation, as opposed to just simple looking. Experimental observation, mathematical reasoning. See, the antecedents of this, those who sort of led up to this, Copernicus demonstrated the mathematical simplicity of the heliocentric versus the geocentric model. That is, he pointed out that the mathematical simplicity of a universe, of a solar system, the sun is the center of it, not the earth, because you have fewer concentric circles. See, and well, just Kepler, another forerunner, introduced the concept of mathematical harmony. That is, he demonstrated the mathematically perfect and exact orbits of the heavenly bodies. Now what is this? Is this something? He's the one who said God ever geometrizes. God ever geometrizes. What is the difference in thinking? Well, it's this. In 17th century thought, when 17th century man, before these fellows, thought about why the planets, why the sun, for instance, is so constant and the moon so predictable, the answer is, well, they follow the plan of God. They do what God has them do. And that settled the question. And to many, when Kepler showed that whether God did it directly or not, that the heavenly bodies showed a mathematical harmony, a mathematical consistency, it seemed to many, not to us, working at a different age, but it seemed to many that was taking God out of it. That you're reducing it to some kind of mechanical. And of course, many were. You see, there's a shift in this, the significance of this is a shift from theology to mathematics. Y'all see that? A shift in the thinking. And that seemed to many to detract from God. In fact, many skeptics jumped on this and said, aha, you see, well, does it really detract from the role of God? He pointed out the aesthetical perfection of elliptical planetary objects, the beautiful symmetry, mathematical predictability of it. Roger Bacon, the founder of modern scientific thought, pointed out the mistakes of Aristotle, which was considered heretical. Aristotle was wrong about a lot of things. And as did Robert Grosse Testa. He also published work pointing out the mistakes. The point is that Aristotle is losing his hold. The Aristotelian cosmology is beginning to lose its hold. And theology is beginning to lose its hold. As you know, in Thomas Aquinas, Aristotle and theology were synthesized. It became the same thing. You know that very well by now. So these were the antecedents. That is, before Galileo, there began to be appreciation for the mathematical quality of the movement of the heavenly bodies. And Aristotle is losing his hold. Galileo introduced the combination of theory and experiment. This is the basics of the scientific method we already studied. You get an idea, and you experiment or test in a way that you can to see if it will hold, to see if it works, to see if it's true. Now, Galileo often used thought experiments. He didn't have a lot of technology at his hand, and many things you cannot experiment, actually. So he used thought experiments, that is, hypothetical descriptions of experiments they never actually carried out because of time, because of expense, because of not having access to various things. Now, that wouldn't be acceptable today too much, but it's certainly, although they're interesting, you see something like this today in the modern think tanks, where they will, in effect, carry out thought experiments in areas where it is impractical, if not impossible, to actually carry out an experiment for all kinds of reasons. Now, Galileo actually performed some experiments, which was radically new. For instance, a ball rolling down the inclined plane, the rate of acceleration. Something as simple as that. Doesn't seem very simple to us. And of course, he's best known for the use of a telescope. The art of grinding lenses had advanced to the point where he could build a telescope and use it to actually look at heavenly bodies the way that man had not before. So the characteristic of the new science, as I indicate here, was theory plus experiment. That makes it science in the modern sense. It wasn't very sophisticated, but it was science, theory plus experiment. One thing to say how something will work is something else to test it and see. The goal of expressing laws of nature, this is the second characteristic, the goal of expressing laws of nature as mathematical relationships among measurable variables. That is, there was a new interest in not simply look at how nature worked, changing weather patterns and the fact that ice melted at a certain temperature. The idea of not simply saying, well, God made it that way. That's medieval man. But wanting to know exactly how it works, to reduce it to mathematical formulations or measurable, working with measurable variables. So, you begin to now, interesting, we, today, our modern thinking, we consider it very normal to operate mathematically. For instance, our culture is very receptive to the touch of daily lives. For instance, we want to know people. For instance, whereas medieval man, he would care whether it was hot or cold, we want to know what the temperature would be. Right? We expected what the temperature would be. How many degrees? What's the percentage of humidity? It might rain tomorrow. Well, we want to know what? 40% chance of rain. And we're very exact, we're not mathematically exact with our time because we have the technology. We start class right at the time we're supposed to. And we get up at a certain time. And we calibrate our distance in miles per hour to travel. And so forth. Very mathematical, very exact. It's hard for us to imagine a world where everything is in approximation. We didn't carry clocks around. Temperature is an approximation. Some cultures have been an approximation, but we say this is cultural anthropology. Now, the characteristic of the new science was experimental, but not completely empirical. It did not leave out the theoretical side. The use of imaginative new concepts. For instance, motion in a vacuum. It's a new concept. So they didn't know how to make a vacuum. They didn't have the tools to make a vacuum, but they could theorize concerning the concept. Later on, when they could make a vacuum, they could try it. With Galileo, it's a very important statement before, teleological explanation, about which we said so much. Teleological explanation gave way to descriptive explanation. Not why, but how. See, medieval man, if the weather changed, he did not ask the question, how did it change? But why did it change? As long as he knew why it changed, he didn't care how it changed. Got that? Why does the why do plants come up when you water them, not when you don't? They asked that question. They didn't ask how is it that, or why. So now we have that. This is scientific. The efficient, rather than the formal or final causes became important. And now harking you back to my thing, what I put on the board for you. You know what those terms mean. Now it became the efficient cause. The efficient cause. How does it work? Now, again, listen, by our viewpoint, we see this for what it is, that is, being no threat to theology. That doesn't threaten heaven. You want to know how it works. Matter of fact, in my opinion, it increases our appreciation of the wisdom of God. You see some marvelous intricacies of biological organisms. But to medieval men, or to men of this age, it seems that this is a threat to heaven, to God, to theology. Because if you were truly God, then the only question you would ask would be, why is it good? But you see, we can ask both questions, can we not? Why and how? Both are legitimate questions, and one does not rule out the other, and one does not threaten the other. They would enhance each other. They would inform each other. That's what they did in cases. So nature came to be seen as particles in motion. Galileo's unobserved, or ultimate constituents of nature, operated the same as observed constituents. That is, what we look around, what we see is matter in motion. The material world takes on a significance of its own. You got that? The material world is not simply a reflection of heaven in the Platonic sense, but it really is something to be taken seriously. It exists on its own. See, in the theological view, although it took the Aristotle's cosmology. The cosmology of 17th century thought was Aristotelian, but its epistemology was Platonic. That is, here is the ideal of God. And here are things. The things were simply reflections of the reality. This is the reality, and this is the reflection. Now, for Galileo, things take on a value in and of themselves. That is, matter and motion. It depends on how you look at it. Did he rule out God? No, didn't rule out God. But just simply said that you can know the nature of it. In other words, the medieval thought, that you can tell the nature of a thing only in reference to the ideal. Only in reference to the ideal can you tell the nature of a thing. That's that epistemology. Galileo said you can examine the thing and know the nature of it by looking at it. Without reference to the ideal.
Take a storm, some thunderstorm. You see, what is the nature of it? What is going on? What is happening in all of this? Sunny and bright, and now later it's thunder and lightning. Okay. In the earlier thoughts, they would say, well, what is going on is
that God is reminding us how weak we are. God is perhaps angry. In other words, it is an act of God which has some meaning for us. It's up to us to find out the meaning. That's what's going on. Is it a judgment? Is God angry because we missed church last Sunday? Why did lightning strike this tree? Is it because somebody was playing slap and tickle on there last week? I was carrying on under the tree. So God is telling us something. You got the point? It's just now, but after Galileo, men begin to ask the question, when the storms, what is it? And they would think of it not in terms of, or they would ask the question, what is going on? What is this thing? What's happened? They would have wanted to begin to talk about air currents and change the temperature. Now again, to many of us, seen that, you'd say, well, you're ruling God out. We would say, because you don't have to choose. But that's not how they look at it. That is the theological mind. Does that answer your question? Okay. Now, the central categories were mass, space, and time, which is good science, isn't it? That we operate in. So we have mass, operating in a certain space and a period of time. Change equals the rearrangement of the particles in space and time versus the transition from potentiality to actuality. 17th century science or thought was the only change is from potentiality to actuality in terms of the ideal. Potential to actuality. Here, again, it was simply changes in the particles, in the position of the particles. Like the weather changes in the water vapor. Mass and velocity were seen as primary qualities. Color, temperature, texture were seen as secondary qualities. These were purely subjective. The first you could measure. Secondly, they saw it as a reaction to senses because they could measure things. Galileo said, I cannot believe that there exists an external body to anything other than their size, shape, or motion, which could excite our taste, sound, and odors. Indeed, I should judge that if ears, tongues, and noses should be taken away, the number, shape, and motion of bodies would remain, but not their taste, sound, and odors. I again judge that heat is altogether subjective. He was wrong about that, of course, but his point is that it's fire hot only for somebody there to get a finger burn. And somebody was standing around the fire and goes marshmallows. Otherwise, it's fire hot. He didn't count it to heat waves, you see. But it's subjective. It's like it's something sour only somebody's there to taste it.
Free fall, of course.
Yeah. You know, the old story, the tree falls and woods, and you might hear it, you might around. Those are the hair. We know now that the sound waves are there. They're picked up by near them, fine, if they're not, it doesn't change the sense of character of the impact. The action. But that was his approach. Now, but you see, basically it's a contradiction of this idea. Galileo's criteria for distinguishing between primary and secondary qualities were measurability and reduction to mathematical presentation. That is, you could measure the weight of something, but you could not measure the taste of it. So that was secondary. You take salt, you can take a cup of salt and measure it to get the mass, to the weight, the volume of something. And you can weigh it to get the mass of it, the weight of it. But if you want to know if it's salty or not, you have to taste it. You can't measure that. So it's a secondary quality.
matter of judgment.
To a fish, salt water doesn't seem salty.
To a freshwater fish, it would.
So they're good. Now, the point is that deaf people do not agree on that. How can you take the human testimony? I said, well, yeah, it's salty. But how do you know what he's feeling or he's sensing? He called this permanence, that which can be measured and expressed mathematically. Well, that's very narrow, isn't it? That narrows it down. That narrows the primary qualities down to very few. And well, he listed them here. Mass and velocity, about it. How heavy it is, how big it is, mass, and is it moving, and so what's speed. Descartes developed the philosophical expression of Galileo's paradigm, that is, the radical dualism of matter and mind, the metaphysical chasm between the observed mind and the observed world, Descartes in philosophy, what Galileo did in science, and that is, he tried to distinguish between the mind which observes and that which is, it does observe. And he, you know, you call, you study history of philosophy, Descartes, Seller, cogito, ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, therefore he said that nothing can be absolutely certain unless because the only thing that can be certain is the mind itself because it is thinking. Everything else, you have an element of doubt because you don't know whether you're dealing with the thing itself or your observation. And what he did was the Cartesian philosophy is a continuum, the chain. It works up, Descartes, he decided, well, the one thing he could be certain of was that he was, and because if he was, he couldn't think about it. I think, therefore, I am, and if I am, and he argued, and he reasoned in a deductive chain, if I am, and that, then he does got a little must be a God, because I would call it a chain, but he reasoned up to the credibility of the God of the material world and of God based upon the existence of mind. That approach, this is true, that's called Cartesian. But anyway, what he was doing, the point is that Galileo in the science was drawing a line for the first time between what there was, whereas the medieval man would look at something and say, that's what it is. Why? I saw it, or I see it, or I touch it, that's what it is. Galileo said, we need to be careful about that because the thing is what it is, but in some cases, we can't be sure because we might be fooled. We have to distinguish between the observation and the thing observed. And I think we can see that. For instance, one of the things we realize is that things are always what they seem. Well, look at Galileo in theology. He himself was a devout Catholic. He found no conflict between his scientific and his religious beliefs. He held the Bible should not be looked to for scientific truth. He said that he was right, wasn't he? There was no conflict. Now, church fathers didn't agree with him, but he felt. You understand the significance of this, though? Why they would see any detraction from the divine elements being. I don't say the detraction from the divine, just didn't want to think about it. You see, you find out how, it's like this. By the way, this, since you see the reversal of this, I laugh. There's been several articles written, some scholarly essays written in the past few years, pointing out that we had a reversal of roles, and that is that the religious prejudice that used to belong to the Roman Catholic Church, and other religious of the church fathers, against scientists, has now been reversed, so that many who are practicing what I define in this class as scientism practicing religious prejudice against against believers. You got that? Whereas the church fathers practice religious prejudice against what they would consider the unbelievers. That's been reversed, so that we now have a Virginia religious prejudice practice against believers. And in modern religion, scientism, since religion has become a religion, there's several scientists from within the discipline that point out have referred to the high priesthood of scientism and how they tolerate and do with their own. And in this particular book, I'll go past the question tonight.
Who's saying this? Christians saying this?
Both Christians and non-Christians are saying this. But the reason I thought of this, the particular example of this, whereby the church fathers were saying, well, if you say that they were saying, well, if you mathematically describe as matter in motion the acts of nature, you're ruling God out. Which is, Galileo says, not true. And we know that it's not true. Our mathematical description of what goes on in the natural order does not in any way rule God out. But you see that it's an interesting frame of mind that many scientists now, who are getting to deal with scientism, they operate exactly that way. They think, well, if we can explain how it happened, that rules God out. It's a real religious prejudice. That's it. No, we used to think God did, but now we know how it happens. Oh, did that. It's like, why is there so much interest, by the way, in trying to, and this is a contradiction, in the laboratory to try to create life from non-life? Why to try to engineer spontaneous generation? Well, what's the contradiction there? Yeah, true engineering is not spontaneous. But they're trying to engineer it. Why? So they can say, well, you know, it just happened. Why? Because we made it happen. Which is really silly. It's like saying you get this medical scientist who spent 40 or 50 years running off the equipment, and invest in mind, and they finally get a protein sequence. You know, they say, well, we got life. We did it. They say, well, we proved it just happened. No, they didn't do anything of the sort. If they proved anything, they proved the opposite. They had too great of intelligence to make it happen.
Yeah.
But they didn't prove anything about the original beginning. It's all they proved what might have happened. But you see, picture the day when the prejudiced scientists manages to produce something that people will agree upon as life in the test tube, and he says, ah, I now understand how it happens. That proved that God didn't do it. It proves that God doesn't exist, doesn't prove anything of the sort. Well, if that could happen, then science, and nobody's even come close to that. If it did happen, hypothetically, then at best, what they proved anything, they proved how they did it. But to show how it was done doesn't prove. That's like, you can have this at a simple level, like saying, suppose you look at a textbook and you had an experiment that was first done by a man named Smith, John Bell, it was an experiment. Very complicated experiments. You couldn't probably look up in your chemistry lab and you reproduce it. He used the chemicals he did, the amounts he did, in order that he did, put the potential he did, lead them all to the correct, the right moment, just like he did. Look, what do you get? You get what he got. And so you write it up, and in your conclusion, you said, I have now followed these steps, and therefore I have demonstrated that God and God does not exist. Your professor said one. Proves what? Yeah, but I find out how you do it. That surely doesn't exist. That's the only thing of the sort. All you know is you did it the way he did it. Understand?
Well, God, and this applies not just to abiogenesis or spontaneous generation, it applies to the whole. You see, Galileo said that if we discover how God does some things, it does not say anything about the existence of God. It just says we discovered how he set it up. But again, the early church fathers said, well, my point here is, the early church fathers said, if you demonstrate how God did it, you're saying the existence of God himself. Galileo said no. Well, point is that many practitioners of modern scientism say exactly what the church fathers used to say. We demonstrated the method, therefore we have removed the author, we removed the original creator, and then we saw no logical connection at all. If there is a logic based on probability, it goes the other way. Well, that's my point. Now, he was a devout believer. He looked upon nature as the sole source of scientific knowledge, but along with Scripture, also a way of knowing God. Would you agree with that? Would you agree that nature is the sole source of scientific knowledge? Sole source of scientific knowledge. Of course it is. Science in the pure sense. Science in the pure sense cannot. It's only known by nature. Why? By examination. Because science, you can only know that observation or experimental reproducibility, that kind of thing. But keep in mind what I told you, that it's only a tiny, tiny fraction of what we know is scientific knowledge. And the other ways of knowing things are equally as valuable. And science, the very definitions I've talked about already, covers a very narrow sphere. And so what he said is true. But he said, but would you agree with the second part of the sentence, that nature is also a way of knowing God? Yeah, that's true. Heavens declare the glory of God. Firmament shows forth his handiwork. Romans 1 says that his everlasting power and divinity are clearly made manifest, how? Being seen in the things that are created. Therefore, it's fall. Being manifest in the things that is made. Yep, so it does. I think it's very clear. Now, remember the old Moody series on nature, on what the scripture is called, where they would show different aspects of nature to demonstrate things about God's Moody science series. We came out with that and still make it. They were good. Not they did now, but they would show the marvels of nature. I love to watch these nature specials on television.
Because they are.
Very scientific, and they are. In the physical sense, and photography is amazing. And through micro photography, what you call it later, photograph things, tell us microscopically. You can see things you can't see with the naked eye. And I think it's marvelous. I like to watch it for two reasons. First of all, I like to watch it because you get an amazing insight into the extreme intelligence is obviously there in the design of the natural order. The complexity, the interdependency, the specialization. Also enjoy watching because it's the best comedy show. It's very close to Cosby in their comment. I was watching one the other night, and I just called it the outsider. Time and time again, nature gave these, and they developed the. Why? How these different animals, how it was simply an expression of the so-called laws of evolution. The need is a sufficient cause. They evolved these because they needed them. Time and that message, time and time again. Sort of absurd, cool idea. I mean, from a scientific point of view, it's absurd. They needed these, they absolved them, and they did evolve them, and that's how they got this. And it's really just the superstitions. So you get this amazing combination of scientific quality. You have really beautiful photography, observation,
and really superstitious kind of comment on it. It's like you had, it's almost like you had a 16th century man commenting on a 20th century event. You see my point? It's really superstitious. I said this one the other night. It was a little change. I've been a long time. It was absolutely nervous. I enjoy looking at that because, whereas they, the mysteries of nature and marvels of nature, you really see the wisdom of God. I love it. I love that just having a comment he did, put my own voice comment on it. A little more readable. Galileo put nature and scripture on the same level as paths to God. Now, his successors were to subject biblical theology to natural theology. As with the birth of it, as science became de rigueur, science became stylish, became the new way of thinking, then theology suffered. But Galileo put them as equal paths to God. And I think that might be hard to understand, but at least he is. With final causality dismissed, God became the first cause, the first link in the chain of efficient causes. The original creator of the interacting atoms in which could reside all subsequent causality. According to Galileo, nature once created was independent and self-sufficient. Now, you agree with that? Nature once created is independent and self-sufficient. How many agree with that? Nature once created independent and self-sufficient.
Miracles took place.
Well, but miracles do not fall in the realm. They're the supernatural. What's interesting, I think he's wrong. He was wrong. But you see, that was a very popular idea for a long time. Before, that idea was where it was possible up to the middle of the century. But now, with the different thinking in the system, the electron microscope and through other equipment and techniques. Whereas once, even Christians, scientists, viewed nature, apart from supernatural, miracles, supernatural, but nature itself as being basically operating mechanically. A simple cause and effect, God the original cause. However, that has become less certain. Because, as the scientists are able to look closer and closer at nature, the mechanics will become less and less, they're less and less certain of the mechanics. That is, on certain things now, if you just observe simple things, you would say, yes, it goes on.
He made speculation that maybe the problem is God of his sustaining comes in at that level.
Yes, that's exactly right. This is a question. Now, before at a very simple level, you would say that nature operates mechanically. That is, you plant corn, you get corn. You plant two grains of corn, you get a plant for each. Very predictable. And you water the growth of the corn, it fertilizes the health, bugs the youth, provide, so you can, pretty predictable. And centrifugal force always operates the same mathematical level, and so on and on. And so that level, just sort of observation, you seem to have a pretty kind of universe. It's just the sort of new observations where subatomic particles, the atom is called that because atom means not cuttable. If it was once thought to be an indivisible element, and it's not.
And what's happening is, with observation, that there has been, questions been raised about, is there an essential difference between, this is what I'm sure the question is talking about, is there an essential difference between matter and energy? The question is, there a line between, is matter one kind of thing and energy another kind of thing, or is matter simply a form of energy? And the latest thinking is that matter is just a form of energy. We call matter. And according to the rules, that is, and not only are physicists not able to explain the rules that govern the cause that keep the mechanics, not able to explain the mechanics by which things are held together. What is put about mechanics seem to predict the opposite. All part of the is why this energy, why is the point of matter is energy? Why is the energy working systematically? Is it simply gravity? Why does it work systematically to be in an orbital way, for instance, the whole concept of gravity, so that things hold together? You have that. Why this energy does not quite do this energy on this thing itself. And so that's the question.
This is such a new area though, isn't it, logical thing that it's very possible that there are mechanics that explain this thing, we just can't discover the mechanics.
Okay.
We're just beginning to see some things that we're gonna be able to say in the future in the development tools to study.
Yes. I think that possibility will hold out, rather than going ahead of the evidence. But it's true. But
it's kind of arrogant to think that. Especially if we look back on history and say, look how much things have changed, the view of the universe has changed,
yes.
To think that now we have the answer.
Yeah. That's very sound thinking. On the other hand, I think we ought to be at that level, be open to the possibility that the sustenance of God does operate there, not other places. You see, but it doesn't. We don't have to. That is, we do not have to. Michael, you raised this. Let's listen to what I'm saying here. We are not waiting until we discover that it takes the existence of energy as matter requires a non-mechanical supernatural act or force. If matter and energy are these things, we must not wait until we don't have to sit back and say, well, if we discover that. The process whereby energy operates in such an integrated way to become matter, and that requires a procedure, a process that is non-mechanical, supernatural, is made to be discovered. We do not wait till that time comes to affirm the sustaining power of God by him. Colossians says, through him all things consist, all things are held together. Now we may find an explanation of how that works in physics. Or we may not, but whether we do or not, is my point. It doesn't do with our affirmation of that text, because the very mechanical forces, we have no way of knowing how the mechanical forces themselves are dependent upon a non-mechanical process to sustain them. All we can do is see them, observe them, and measure them. And since the mechanical, as well as the material universe, mechanical processes and the things themselves, require a non-mechanical act to be created. then it logic would drive us, simple not theology, simple logic would drive us to the position that certainly for such a highly intricate and interdependent system to operate would take some kind of oneness. It's like, to use a physical analogy, it's like you can create a concrete block. Then take a whole lot of maintenance. Concrete block, right? Whatever blocks these walls, and they can sort of go on and do what they're supposed to do. System. But we have to have the pattern in 3 days for our cognition.
It uses that to
I think it's possible. But we don't know. Yeah. It doesn't affect our faith in any way. It's just about, I think it's interesting. Though it's interesting, it's all it is. It doesn't prove anything one way or the other any more than you reproduce an experiment you prove the physical man did it in John Butler's suggestion. Has nothing to do with the goal of God. It's just interesting.
Well, it could have a problem.
Could. But I think we ought to wait and see. We may never know. The interesting thing is, I'll say this, and we'll take our full 10-minute break, is that the new physics is creating a lot of, you have an increasing percentage of those who are working in it who are becoming deliberate. And like Robert Jastrow, or religious in some sense, it's a good way from the old purely materialistic, mechanical way of thinking. Men like Hoyle and Jastrow, and many others who are backing off from the old paradigms of pure mechanics and saying that we have to look outside the system for some explanations. The explanation don't exist in the system, like the old stuff. So you got Hoyle looking to the intelligent universe. Astro looking to God. So it is love. Things are certainly. It's shaking the old foundations of here. Okay, we'll come back. We'll review this later. We'll come back to this. Talk about it. And his proposition that nature once created was independent and self sufficient. We're kind of sneaking a beat ahead in our thought. We're going to come back to this later. But I think it's important to tie these things in as we go, because this is just how, this is the proper way to think about these things. Now, what we were talking about, let me illustrate what we were talking about last hour. And I'll give you an example. We were saying that the old mechanical view, the materialist view, or whose held sway for a long time, was that Galileo was right, that nature once created is independent, self-sufficient, does not need an outside force, does not need any kind of maintenance, direct maintenance from God. We were saying that held true until fairly recently, when the new physics is questioning this. That, in other words, whereas Galileo said you go back to God as the first cause, and kind of deist. Of course, as you understand, that deism was based a lot on Galileo, that God just simply started it, like the clockmaker starts it, and then it goes on. It doesn't have to come in and touch it to keep it going. Now, to illustrate this the new physics, to show you a band who at random, the old physics, which really, if you get your average popular atheist man on the street, he still holds, he's outdated most of this thing, he's certainly outdated in this mechanical view. The idea was that nature was utterly predictable. Everything was, it could be predictability was the genius of the soul of the old view. Back to Galileo, you understand? And it's sort of like this. If you diagram it this way, if you release an electron molecule in a box, electron, by its very nature, you could predict that it would head off in a certain direction, say this direction. It's known. Would always travel in that direction. They're utterly predictable. Therefore, and it would react in a certain way, bounce off of the walls at a predictable angle, on and on.
you could simply compute where it started and how long it you could compute, since you knew how fast it traveled, you could compute by knowing where it started, you could dial in the known, the predictable direction of travel, an angle, and how long it had been doing it, and therefore at any time you could predict where it would end up, where it would be, what its position would be at any time. Simply mathematically know where it would end up. But now we know that's not true. Now we're not sure why, but if you release, the point is now that the electron molecule is not predictable, it's liable to go off in this direction and begin a sequence like this, or it's liable to go in this direction and begin a sequence like this, or it's liable to go in this direction and begin a sequence like this, or it's liable to go in this direction and begin this sequence, or it's liable to go in this direction and begin this sequence, or an infinite number of them. So there's no way of knowing, understand? So since you don't know which direction it's going to head off in, you have no way of knowing where it's going to end up. Does that make sense to you? That's a rough illustration of its unpredictability. It's random. Now, remember on the last of the hour, I mentioned that there are many in the field of the hard sciences. Fred Hoyle, he was one of the co-founders of the steady state theory. He's a British astronomer. I said that there are many in the field. Bush raised the possibility of having an apologetic value or what he did. And I was saying that many of the top scientists in the world are now becoming more religious in some sense than they were. And he's one of them. I'll set an example. Here's what he says. In learning about quantum mechanics, students are usually told that because macro events, those in everyday life, large events, involve such a large number of atoms, they are determined by a vast number of individual quantum mechanical occurrences, and therefore depend only on statistical averages, which can be calculated with complete certainty. That's the knowledge. In other words, if at the molecular level, electrons and neutrons and the other neurons, so forth, if they operate unpredictably, why do we not have a random universe instead of an ordered universe? If you have unpredictability at the macro level, how can you get predictability at the macro, the large level? How can the molecules of this chair hold together and make a chair? If at the micro level, they operate randomly, and you wall, the exploding block or whatever. He said the answer is because any object, any macro event requires a large number of micro events, then on the average, it averages out toward, when he said what the textbook, he's right, of course, we know what we're talking about. What the textbook say, what the standard non-theistic answer is, that if you get enough micro random events, you'll get macro ordered events. Or because you have so many micro events, which are random, they average out to macro events order, which of course doesn't make any sense. That's all Hoyle's saying. He recites the standard answer. That is, why don't we get randomness? Why do we get, in other words, why do we say that our macro world looks as if this is true, but we know when we look at microphysics, this is what's true? Why is the whole universe chaotic instead of order? Okay, here's his answer. You understand? He says this. Macro events are represented as being completely predictable, whereas micro events that make them up are not. Y'all get that sentence? Get it again. It's too mean. That was good on Sunday. Macro, large events, are represented as being completely predictable. They are. Whereas the micro events that make them up are not. But this separation seems quite arbitrary. You see? That's the conventional wisdom. And he said, that seems quite arbitrary. Taken to its logical conclusion, quantum mechanics, you got this, taken to its logical conclusion, as opposed to real logic, as others, quantum mechanics, that's over here, should lead to a spreading vagueness in the world, even to the extent of making vague the events of everyday life. But apparently this does not happen. If you hold a match to this page, it will burn, an event which is completely predictable. Hence, in some way, there must be a sharpening of the picture which compensates for the uncertain fuzziness which quantum mechanics predicts. And it goes on, so forth. But you see the point? What he's saying is that there. How do we move between randomness at the molecular level and order at the observed level? And he tries to come up with an answer. But you see the point is before, when this view helps, this is Galileo. Well, he was not. I didn't operate at that level. This is Galileo, not only predictable. Once it started, it goes in the same direction, same speed. And so, this is a machine that needs no, it's just a machine. But that is gone now. So to explain, just explain what's going on, that how do we explain the gap between chaos, a randomness at the micro level, what we're saying is that maybe this is where we see the sustaining power of God by him all things exist. But there may be an acting. My point is, if there is a mechanics, if the answer is a mechanical answer, we don't have it yet. And it may be, it's not the human can't as well. That's why Jastrow is saying, because I can make the creator God, not just as the creator of the machine, but the one who's not perfect. And, well, but really, I'm using poor language, I'm not being accurate. Actually, the difference between the old view and the new view is not the difference between a machine that runs by itself and a machine that needs tinkering. The answer is between the view of the universe as a machine and another, and the view of the universe as something else. There was a machine, and the machine analogy has to be thrown out completely. That's why, interestingly enough, many are now beginning to speak of the universe not as a machine, but as an organism. Analog which won't hold anymore. Yes, sure.
At the micro level, you're talking about an electron, right? But are you talking about the electron within the confines of the atom? Because the atom is structure. I mean, certain atoms have free electrons that can be induced by electromotive force one way or the other. But when you start breaking down the conformity of that atom, you do wind up with chaos.
The question is, since the electron acts the way it does, why is the atom systematic? Why does it operate systematically? Why does it hold together and form an atom? That's the question. You can describe how that it does, but quantum mechanics says it shouldn't do that.
I guess you
should do any number of things.
You still have never really seen the electron.
No.
There may be something beyond that that maybe there is.
That's right. That's what we're saying. We don't know that yet. You understand my answer to anything? Yeah. So, in other words, it's true. You look at the atom, you look at it, you describe order. You see order. It's predictable. But the electron level, it shouldn't be predictable.
We're talking about that. The quark level? Is that what the random movement, isn't that the quarks,
you
have a random motion.
Quarks? Oh, quarks, yes. I don't know much about it. I've done about as far as I should go. I'm not a physicist. I really don't know. I should be. If I'd answer that question, I don't know. I agree that one. Good as you can be.
I'm not sure about it.
Yeah. What's going on? I'm talking about quartz and the other names too. There's a whole. What happens? They're finding matter elements, we call them, existing at levels very close to pure energy, and operating all kinds of ways that nobody ever guessed before. Longer than ever.
I guess what I'm asking, do we know what the motion of quartz is?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Okay, let's get back to Galileo. Any other questions I have for our discussion? Well, you get the point. I think here's time to look at this question. And it's very much up in the air now. That is, from a naturalistic point of view, it's up in the air, at least. So Galileo held third, that nature once created was independent and self-sufficient. That's called the question. It was accepted for a long time. Many fears, I say, that the idea of a complete mechanical world would destroy belief in God, and I've already talked about that. The Roman Catholic Church attacked Copernicus and Galileo. It was because Aristotelian elements had become church orthodoxy, and I've talked about that. Okay, come out to the Reformation and modern science. I've already pointed out that the Reformers did not change, the Reformers themselves did not have a different cosmology than Thomas Aquinas. That is, Martin Luther and John Calvin held exactly the cosmology of Thomas Aquinas for all practical purposes. However, out of the Reformation as an intellectual phenomenon, there arose modern science. And one thing we're going to see is that science rose from theistic thought, not atheistic thought. Reformation did not cause the rise of modern science. Very clearly. The Reformation and the scientific revolution were simultaneous in history. Modern science was born out of the Christian worldview, not out of the Reformation. But it was born out of the Christian worldview. Basically, by that I mean God as creator, the universe as creation. Alfred North Whitehead and J. Robert Oppenheimer, for instance, they talk about that. If you want to read your sources on this. You start with the medieval insistence on the rationality of God and the general principles made possible by the intelligent rationality of the personal God. That is, if there is a God, he is a rational God, and if God is a rational God, then his universe is a rational universe, therefore subject to examination, measuring. It is not random. It is rational. Modern science is based upon the idea. You see, now listen to me. It is theism, not atheism, that serves as a basis, logical basis, for science. Science, it's interesting. Science is like analogous to modern education. I really get mad when people like to act like religion is an intruder in the school system. Because the school system, the church gave America's school system. So it was ours in the beginning. We gave it to them, now they want us out. Well, that's the same thing true of science. Science was ours in the beginning, and now they want us out. And I point out that, logically, if you are not a theist, then you have no grounds for being a scientist. Because either the universe is, either there's a God or there's not a God. And if there is, and that is a rational God as opposed to the God of Hinduism, which is impersonal. But if you have a rational God, can you predict a rational creation by that God? And therefore, creation would expect to be a rational creation because there's a rational God. If there is no God, there can be no reason. Because there's no reasoner. And if there is no ultimate rationality, then whatever universe might happen to exist in and of itself cannot be rational. Did you get that? Whatever universe might exist, it exists in and of itself, and since there is no transcendent reasoner, there can be no reason. Therefore, we must have what the quantum theory of physics predicts, an irrational whatever you have. I want to call it an irrational universe, but the point is that you just have an irrational something or other. It would not be cohesive enough to call the universe anything else. So without a rational God, you can only predict an irrational something or other, or more logically, you can only predict nothing. Get it? If you have no rational God, you can only predict nothing, which is the primary prediction. Or if you're going to have something, it has to be an irrational something or other. You don't see that? But if you have a rational God, then you can predict a rational prediction. And science is born out of the prediction of the rational natural order. Therefore, science historically, and therefore we are not surprised to find science historically rooted in theism. We find it logically rooted in theism. Only the theist has the right to be a scientist, logically. Because an atheistic scientist, and there are many who are atheists and many who are theists. Of the myriad theistic scientists, they at least are consistent. It is the atheistic scientist who is considered rational. Why? Because he's working on that which cannot exist. All right, so just a little deep. Would y'all see that? That's why I kind of shook them up when they got to this, got the quantum physics and found randomness at the other level. Well, most of them ignore it. Now, of course, many atheists will understand it. But you find, I don't know how it's emotion or whatever, but you don't find, you commonly find scientists who are theists in some sense. And it's a growing number. Or you find maybe what Paul did, trying to move some other explanations, which I'll talk about later. Then you become systematic believers. You realize how many men have been made to God through science. We purify the science. Now, the others, they just ignore it, they still don't think about it. Or they fall back on metaphysical nonsense. Such as, given enough time, everything. I read that, actually, both ways actually say that. Given enough time, everything has happened, therefore, this world must have happened because it's a thing, and everything must happen. So the universe has been more being a thing. It was predictable because everything must happen, given enough time. We laugh about this just because God has PhDs think that way. So either books. It's very Platonic, you kind of deductive reasoning, except that the premise will hold up. If it's true that you've got enough time, everything is happening, then you may be on something that that's the thing is true. And many of the scientists themselves point that out. So you either have God or you have metaphysical analysis, or you just don't think about it. To answer that question, that's the kind of metaphysical superstition that many use. Given enough time, everything must happen. Everything. Given enough time. That means not only does this universe exist, but every other kind of possible universe exists. Either has or don't. Given enough time. This is time that was the magic one. Adaptation to time. Whoa! That's impossible. What you see in that 4.5 billion years? Oh, I see. I gave the illustration last time I taught this class. Did you see it go this time? I said, can I ask you a question? He's a fan. You're in that class? Yeah. I think it's all fit with his illustration. That man, unaided, no interference whatever, how long will it sit there? Well, the answer is as long as we leave it. Will it sit there 5 minutes, or will it ever in and of itself rise and stay? Okay, let's give it 10 minutes. And then it will rise up in and of itself. Unaided, it will rise and sit in 5 to 10 minutes. I'm going to go, I'm going to think that it's twice as likely to do it in 10 minutes as it is in 5. Oh, come on, it's not logical. See, you won't do it in 5 minutes, but you see 10 minutes is twice 5, right?
Therefore,
it may not be much to me, but it's you want to have a thing. It's not around the thing. Is it? I admit to you that it's not very likely. It's not very likely that it will rise in and of itself to its unit by itself. But you know, it's not very likely. I admit that now. Don't you know? I admit that. But it's twice as likely to do it in 5 minutes or 10 minutes as 5 minutes, right? Now, sit down in 10 minutes, it's still not very likely. I admit that. I'm intelligent. But in 20 minutes, it's twice as likely to do it as in 10 minutes, right? How many think they'll do it in 20 minutes? Wait. How many think they'll do it in a year? Likelihoods will increase in a year. Roughly at 5 years. Is it more likely to rise by itself in 5 years than in 5 minutes? Is it? I think I have no idea. No. You see, it can't happen in time and then do it. But time and then do it. You can do it 5 years, or you can do it 500 years, or you can do it 5 million years, or you can do it 500 million years, or 500 billion years. It can't happen, understand? It isn't going to rise to the ceiling, and it doesn't become more likely. The idea that given enough time anything can happen simply is not true. Oh, yeah. I gave his illustration in that class, and we had a break. I came back in, so I had to see
took you a long time to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my class, you know, I couldn't get their attention, and all of a sudden I looked up and there I was. Well. But my point is, now look at that. We're back, I'm not off the subject. Modern science was born in the Christian worldview. I want you to learn this, that modern science, or science, real science, not scientific, but science, was born historically from the Christian theistic viewpoint, and it rests logically from a theistic view. Now, not all early scientists were Christians, but all lived within the thought forms existent in and produced by Christianity. The Christian faith made possible faith and the possibility of science. The world was viewed as the creation of a reasonable God. It was assumed that if there was no rationality in the first cause or causes, there could be no perceivable order in the effects. Got that? If there is no rationality or order in the cause, there can be none in the effect. Is that true? That has always been observed. If there is no rationality in the cause, there can be none in the effect. You can put a monkey in a room with a typewriter, bang, bang, and he's not going to come up with Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Why? Insufficient rationality. Probably not enough rationality in the cause. To get Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, you've got to have Shakespeare. Somebody knows Shakespeare. You understand that? And time simply will not do it. You can leave the monkey in there for 5 days or 5 years or 5 years, but there's not anybody that's taking the Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Why? Insufficient rationality in the cause. Or you never get the effect, which is the complete play. You understand that, don't you? Yes?
Just so I'm following what you're saying. What do you mean by
existence. Now, is that just meaning someone who believes in God?
Yes, God is creator. He is the universe, created by God.
I remember Mike having a session one time about those who, you know, like in the early days, wind came and destroyed the city because God did it, but then they realized, you know, because of the air currents is one that's explained by laws of science. Then that person would move on to the next level. Well, why was the earth here when God created it?
Yes. We talked about this last time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But you're right. The theism basically is, by that I mean, this is not just a philosophy class, but basically I mean, that is precisely human. I simply mean somebody who believes that the world is a creation of intelligent God. In this context. Okay. Christianity is the mother of modern science historically. To be more precise, let me say it this way. Theism is the logical ground of modern science. Christian theism is the historical source of modern science. That's making more accurate. You got that right there. That theism is the logical ground of modern science. Christian theism is the historical source. So there's a theism which is not Christian theism. A Jew, an Orthodox Jew, would be a theist, but not a Christian. He would be the creator and the creation of the not Christ. Okay. That logically, theism is the ground of modern science. A Christian theism, any theism. By that I mean with a personal God. Christian theism is the historical kind of it. Okay. Now, we come now to, we're looking at Galileo. We see man as a devoted spectator. Now, we're not talking about what is logically sound. We're talking about what happened historically. When the world was devoted from its position as the center of the universe, many felt that man was also devoted as the teleological center. Now that doesn't hold logically. That is, does man as the teleological, that is, the world was created for man, does man as the teleological center of the universe depend upon the earth as the physical center of the universe?
No.
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. They felt that it did. And looking at it from their point of view, can you not be sympathetic? Yeah.
I think I can.
It seemed that way because really, their concept of what I would say, their concept of God is too small. But when we know more about the universe than they did, and so we see that there's no logical connection at all with any thought of the earth. And it's true that if you thought of the earth as the physical center of the universe, then it became easier to think of man as the theological center of the universe. But there's no logical connection whatever. That's on a par, which I talked about before. We were talking about Ptolemy's obvious. That's on a par of thinking that the discovery of the size of the universe or some concept of the size of the universe somehow removes God from it. That God can be the God of a small universe, but not a big one. As long as everybody thought the universe was closed in a small room, they can believe in God. But now we know how large it is, therefore. God is out of the picture, and that's a fault at all. And I pointed out, I needed a woman who knew that Ptolemy said that that was the significance of my pointing out to you. Ptolemy was Omegas, and Ptolemy was the handbook of Ptolemy and the labels, pointed out that Earth was mathematically insignificant. So that, as a matter of fact, they always should have to do what it was good. But So now the man becomes a demoted spectator, historically speaking, and we had to follow Western civilization. Galileo's telescope raised speculation about life on other planets. Why? Well, because they looked at the moon and thought they saw continents, looked at Mars and thought they saw canals, and the mere fact of being able to see other planets closer, other heavenly bodies, other planets closer up, raises speculation. Now, man has always speculated about this, and we're going to do this two or three times in this course, probably. But you know, Joseph Smith, the prophet of God, said that there were people living on the other on the moon, dressed like Quakers. Fred Hoyle is convinced that there's got to be life. There has to be life on other planets. He gives the reasons. What is the argument for life on other planets, though? Let me ask you this: does the Bible? But what I'm saying is that, historically speaking, the possibility of seeing life on other planets reduced man, reduced the theological character of man's existence. Historically, not logically. Let me ask you, does it? Let me ask you, if you think there's life on other planets, should make this issue down. You think there's life on other planets? How many think there is? How many think there might be? Two questions. One, if there is, what does it affect your understanding of biblical theology?
No,
it
doesn't make
it. Okay. Then, but the main important question is, why do you think there is?
Michael is falling into the next fall into the trap.
Gotcha. That is the standard argument. The size of the universe. Just as the size of the universe became an argument for the absence of God, so the size of the universe is the primary argument for a lot of other planets.
Often from the basis of the existence of gas and
this is the climate, so this is where you may be humiliated. So I think you ought to earn your money's worth. This is just your turn. Go ahead. Be silly. Okay. I'm just a kid. Go ahead.
The reason I said that was that, it seems probably isn't, but it seems like probably
why create an infinite, almost infinite number of heavenly bodies that don't put life on one?
But that's not proof.
No, it's not proof. It's suggested.
Yeah.
Well, the argument, though, is that now my island is going to go out. I don't believe my faith in my bread, but I'm in the bread. Because the argument is faulty, it's the same for the idea that there is. That doesn't prove there isn't. But you see, it goes like this from the non theist, the evolutionist, which will argue like this. Well, life arose on this planet because conditions were made possible. Water. Secondly, because there are so many, it is mathematically certain that there are a number of other planets in the universe that should also sustain life. And if life arose on this one, it's mathematically probable that life would arise on the other one. Because that's the old argument of the pen on the table. Can life arise in and of itself? What I say is, of course, this is not what you were saying. If you're talking about creation, God creating life. So the non-theist view argues this way. But what I say is that from everything we know, that the idea that life can create itself and come from non-life is absurd, no matter how much time you give it, or how many planets you give it. You can put water on every planet. Of the untold billions that are there, you can make every one of them. But not a star. You can't start on a 5 million planet. You can put water on every one of them. Give it an atmosphere. You won't get life from non-life. Care how many years you get, so you don't multiply. It can't happen. It's like this. It's like saying this pin won't rise to the top. If I give it 500 billion years, it'll go up. Or if you're saying if I put 1,000 pins on the table, I'm more likely to get one going to the top if I just put one. Is that true? We think right. So if I put 10,000 pins out on these tables, am I more likely to get one going to the top? No, I can fill the world with them. I put 100 billion pins on the table, and I have not increased the probability of it rising to the top by itself. Understand? So I don't increase the probability by giving it one pin an infinite amount of time, nor do I increase the probability by multiplying the number of pins. That's simply not good sound thinking. Okay. So the argument of life. Life, there must be so many planets that can sustain life, and there must have arisen. That's the standard argument. That's what Hoyle uses. And it simply won't hold up. Now, as for the argument from somebody that believes in God, we argue. Now, here's what I consider to be the fallacy in your thing, in that opinion, that suggestion, you want to take this position, is this, that the implicit in that position is the idea, is this statement. If God were not going to put life on more than one planet, why did he go to the trouble of creating so many? Right? Could you agree with that?
Because I don't think it would be any trouble. It's just that it seems possible to me that if you really like it, then
okay. Would you agree with this being implicit, this proposition being implicit in your suggestion? That it is more trouble for God to create than to not create. And it seems to me you're suggesting breaking it down. That is, you're saying, why would God do it if we're not going to put life on more than one? It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, it seems to me we're suggesting that it is more trouble for God to create than to not create, or to create many than to create a few. And the point is that for God, if I understand the God of the Bible, for him to create is not only not difficult, it is a part of his nature to create.
I think my problem is I knew that.
It's like, if I understand God, we're the image of God. Man is created by nature. Why does man create so much he doesn't have to create? How does man create art? Let's make three great music. People that read about her life, people are dead of life, they die. People. Listen, I have no knowledge of great music. I should have that knowledge. I have to learn. But the problem is, I'm not knowledgeable in my life. I should be, but I have the time to learn. But I can follow. Hey, Mom, I'm on the you know, looking at it, at my lower level. You see my point? We're the image of God. We create because we're like him. We create all kinds of things. We don't need to have more utilitarian base, simply because we're like, think about God. All I'm saying is that I'm of the opinion. We're in an area we're all speculating. You might be right, I might be wrong. But all I'm saying is that the argument that God, that from a number, because the argument for life on other planets from the number of other planets seems to me to be making assumptions about God and the world. The assumption, such as that why there's a lot of trouble for him to create them. He didn't have no chance to just think about it. Speak. He said, let there be. And there's more trouble for him to create many than a few. Is it twice as much trouble for God? Does it take twice as much work for God to create two planets as one? No, it takes no trouble for him to create infinite. And he is, by his very nature, he is a God of creation. He creates by its nature, maybe for all kinds of things, have no utilitarian reason, simply because they reflect his. Why is the universe, I'm not saying, why is the light of the universe unnecessarily beautiful? I think it is unnecessarily, as far as function, I think it is unnecessarily beautiful because God is beautiful. His character. Why is there so much variety? Plants and all that. You know what I'm saying? So, I'm not teaching it very well. All I'm saying is I do not accept the proposition that the number of heavenly bodies is an argument for the life of the planets. I think they can exist for all kinds of reasons. You understand? I just don't accept that. And I might be wrong. I can work on the river. Beyond our information. But based on what I do know about God, I just don't accept it. You see, you know, whether you agree or not, you see what I'm saying? Yeah. So, historically speaking, when people begin to look at the other planets through Galileo's telescope, they begin to speculate about life on other planets, and illogically, from my point of view, illogically, they begin to doubt the biblical view of man. Begin to doubt the story. That's the point. Have a good week.